Hey.
Hey. Hey, can I talk to you guys for a second?
Sure.
Over 25 years ago, on September 29th, 1998, we watched a brainy girl with curly hair drop everything to follow a guy she only kind of knew all the way to college. And so began Felicity, the brainchild of J.J. Abrams and Matt Reeves, starring Carrie Russell.
And me, Greg Grunberg, a.k.a. Sean Blumberg. It won't be confusing at all.
And me, Amanda Foreman, a.k.a. Felicity's roommate with the box.
And I'm Juliette Littman. I was not on Felicity, but I remember every moment of it, probably better than these two do. Altogether, we'll be revisiting our favorite moments from the show and talking to the people who helped shape it.
We talked to Carrie Russell, of course, because she's the best.
Yeah.
And also Scott Speedman and Scott Foley.
I was Team Scott. I just want to lay that out there right now. And we also talked to JJ and Matt, the two brains behind this amazing series, and many more people who work behind the scenes and in front of the camera.
From Bad Robot Audio and The Ringer, this is Dear Felicity.
Listen to Dear Felicity on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me in the studio, he'll have the natto. It's Andy Greenwald!
Mm, have you ever had natto, Chris?
I have not, but we're going to talk all about it because that's a big element of Shogun episode 4. Mm-hmm. Kaya's here. Kaya and I were just chatting about East Side versus West Side living and the extent to which our relationship might provide the basis of friendship.
I was
thinking about moving to the West Side, and I asked Kaya, like, were we hanging out or what?
I want to be clear. I don't want to dox anyone, but the thought of you becoming a West Sider is rich. This is a rich text. I don't think it's possible.
Because you think that I would just all of a sudden be like wearing Van slip-ons and...
I think that you would be the documentary version of Will Arnett in Flaked.
But Kaya's not like that.
Yeah, but Kaya's not you. Kaya comes to her West Side-ness naturally.
I gotta say, it is hard to picture you there.
Yeah.
I mean, like...
standing outside of Whole Foods with a mouthful of Zin pouches.
There's a couple things. Kaya is not...
Brother,
again,
have you heard the news about Joe Burrow?
Kaya is a bit younger than us.
Yep.
What's the opposite of a bit? Kaya's younger than us.
Yeah.
Kaya is a native Californian. Mm-hmm. Kaya went to school on the West Side.
Loyola Marymount.
Mm-hmm.
Proximity to the ocean is part of Kaya's core brand identity.
Yeah,
and
true.
Everyone who listens to this podcast can tell.
What's my core brand?
What
should I be proximate to?
A moment ago, you just did the Randy Macho Man Savage voice, imitating yourself hypothetically proselytizing for Zyn nicotine pouches and Joe Burrow's friendship with former President Donald Trump.
There's also, like, not a lot of sweet greens on the West Side. I think in my, like, in Santa Monica, there's only, like, one around me.
God.
You'd have to be an Erewhon guy more.
I can't tell what I'm more sad about. The fact that there's only one sweet green or that's what Kaya thinks I amount to is just a salad.
She's caring for you. Kaya,
well,
again.
I know how integral it is to your day.
Kaya's respectful of you and your process, and also knows that a happy Chris, meaning a Chris who's had his usual leafy greens, makes for a better work environment.
That's true. I mean, I think you guys are both looking out for me, and you want the best for me.
I mean, I would be thrilled if you moved to the West Side.
Thank you.
I just want the Ringer contingent.
Oh,
the Ringer
move
is so
west.
Strong.
And you think
also,
that I'm kind of like a
no,
Oregon Trail
want,
type Francis Parkman kind of guy. Yeah.
I think that there is a level of, it's not cynicism, but I think it's more practicality to what Kaya is saying, because if you were also traveling east to record, some of her daily considerations might be shared considerations. Like, I don't want to do it at this time or during mudslides or whatever
that's
the case may be.
That's bad for you. That's bad for you. If it starts being me and Kai being like, nah, dog, there's a big swell.
It's not. Are you going to shred it? What are you moving to Nazare? No, it is not bad for me because luckily, before all of this nonsense westward migration talk started, I laid down the gauntlet that I am in person only.
I know.
For all podcasts.
Well, then we just establish a Santa Monica studio.
That's right. Maybe we could get a little WeWork going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would have to get a kind of a compound. Is that what you were thinking about?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just
for sure.
Like a couple of small properties behind a firewall. Kind of like James Cameron.
Everybody's got them out in the West Side.
I imagine real estate gets cheaper the closer to the ocean you go, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Accurate?
Yeah, that's the theory.
I'll take everything you guys say into consideration. Today, Andy, we're
talking... CR House Hunt would be... the best pivot for
Shogun,
this podcast.
Do you guys have a smoking shed? Shogun and also The Gentleman, a show on Netflix that got released last Friday. It is a sort of expansion adaptation of Guy Ritchie's 2019 crime movie that I enjoyed quite a bit called The Gentleman. And Guy Ritchie is responsible for this show. So we'll chat a little bit about that. And also, Andy, I wanted to kind of start here. A couple of people had flagged this to us on social media.
Okay.
You and I are known... across the land as the greatest proselytizers for folding laundry TV. You know,
yeah, of course.
If there's anything that we like more, it's not paying attention to what we're watching. It's being able to do household errands.
The podcast is evidence of that.
No, I guess years ago at this point, like I think made some reference to a show that we liked. I can't remember what it was. Right?
We were paying so little attention to it.
I know. I was paying so little attention to what I was even saying at the moment on the podcast. We were talking about the sensation of there's TV where you feel like you have to watch every single frame and be present for it and analyze every single decision that the creators are making and be all just granularly breaking down the text. And then there's TV where you're like, if I walk out of the room and come back in, chances are I'll be able to grasp what's going on here. That angered Sam Esmail, creator of Mr. Robot, director of Leave the World Behind, and he was like...
frequent guest of the Big Picture podcast.
Big Picture, kind of the third chair there.
I would say so.
He was like, you guys are everything that's wrong with American culture.
And then we bought him a coffee. What a guy.
So I mentioned this context because...
Yeah.
In the New Yorker's never-ending pursuit to write lengthy profiles of everybody who was in the Succession writer's room, there is a wonderful piece on Lucy Prebble, who is an accomplished screenwriter and playwright who worked on Succession. Rebecca Mead wrote this piece. I'm being snarky. I actually quite enjoy when Rebecca Mead just spends tons of time thinking about
people who used
to work on Succession.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she also created the show I Hate Susie, which people had been recommending to us for years. I still have not watched.
I would describe it as, and this is me saying it's my deficiency, not my tempo.
Right. Okay.
But I thought it was a very cool idea for a show. Anyway, Rebecca Mead interviewing Lucy Prebble, and they're chatting about life and TV and work. And here's a passage from this piece, okay?
Yes.
Prebble is alert to the evolution of narrative in the digital age and likes to think about how writers and directors might adapt to new technologies. She said, quote, "Over the holidays, I was with my family and my nephews and nieces, and like everybody, they now watch everything with the subtitles on, which I would never have predicted." She realized that her relatives preferred to have more information available on screen to ensure that they weren't missing anything if their attention was divided. Prebble went on, quote, "Like a wanker, I'm spending hours and hours on my stuff, carefully calibrating an actor's performance in the edit, and they're just watching it with the subtitles anyway." She observed, "This is not in a spirit of curmudgeonly nostalgia, but with an open, interested curiosity." Quote, "I'm thinking that now there might be a market for television or drama that's the opposite of grabby. Something's happening all the time, don't look away kind of thing, that Netflixy thing," she said. She cited the example of the Beatles' Get Back. the Peter Jackson documentary about the 1969 recording of Let It Be. Watching that was more like listening to a chatty podcast.
Hey,
Lucy Preble, come on the watch. You could wander away and come back because there were lots of scenes of these incredible geniuses creating in a room together, but they were also being like, shall we have some tea? It suggested to Preble that she might want to experiment with, quote, doing shows that feel like having a bath, where you just want to be in that environment for a long time. I thought this was interesting, not only because obviously this is something that creators are thinking about, is how is their stuff being processed?
Right.
I think, to Sam's credit, like, he puts a ton of thought into every single frame and every single gesture and every single movement that you see on screen. And the idea that dickheads like us are like, do I still have Pringles? Let me go check while it's going is probably maddening to him.
Do you think he hears our voices saying, no, you don't have to pause it? Just ringing in his ears?
But it is interesting to me to know that other creators are thinking about the ways in which these shows are being watched, the behaviors that go into them. And, you know, we're going to have, obviously, a specific conversation about Shogun and The Gentlemen, but I was snickering to myself last night. Just a little private laugh, where I think I got like 40 minutes into The Gentleman and realized that I am currently, while watching The Gentleman, Shogun, my wife and I have been watching Criminal Record on Apple.
Oh, how is that?
It's quite good.
Oh,
it's
good.
It's a really fun mystery. Not fun at all, but it's a good mystery. I started watching Three Body Problem.
But that's a screener flex.
My point is more that I'm watching currently like up to half a dozen hour-long dramas. I think I have to keep like 70 people straight right now.
Yeah.
In terms of like who they are, what they're doing, what they want, like where they are in the story, all this stuff. It's more than maybe the... Yeah, what the fuck is up? Van just walked by. He threw up some gang signs.
But he also then blew us a kiss that was either like, I love you or I'm going to see you in hell.
Yeah, well, I was like, I was telling him he's the best podcaster.
I think that's accurate. It's
So like if you're watching like say four or five shows at any given time, you're keeping like upwards of 70 characters straight in your head. Like if, for as much as probably, you know, people think of us as like the guy from Idiocracy or something, like it is hard to watch TV and just like keep your mind wrapped around all these stories all the time if you're doing it at a high level.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's a very interesting observation, and I think it's a correct one. I also feel like many bold and direct statements, the gradations of how to apply that sort of are not a...
Are you talking about my statement or Lucy Preble's?
Your statement was mid, to be honest.
my statement was like neither funny nor smart.
but I can work with that. That is rough clay that I can use to craft. No. What I mean is like, I think how what she's saying ought to be applied is... there are gradations to that. And what I mean is there is already a rich tradition of let's vibe out in bathwater television. Some of it is called golf. Some of it is called 100-foot wave. Some of it is, for some people, it's like episodes of Chopped. Like, I think people have plenty of access to that sort of programming. It has never gone out of style. When I hear...
Some of us just sit with the screaming thoughts inside of our head. And just say West Side or East Side, who can say?
The way you said West Side or East Side sounded a little ominous also.
Yeah,
no, it's fun to just sit by the gaping hole inside of yourself and just think about it.
Just stare at YouTube streams of the 405.
Really no different. For me, what's interesting about the statement, and I think it's very true, is the way that you can integrate that this bathwater feels great feeling back into grabby television. I say this probably like clockwork every few episodes of The Watch, but like I do think that's still a central part of our particular relationship with TV is this world is coming into my house, so I want to be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I think we go back to shows time and time again, not because of cliffhangers or grabby plot or buzzy themes or whatever that feel of the moment. We go back because we like being in a place with our pals, with our made-up pals. And I think that the very best shows are able to honor that while also doing the stuff they want to do. It's not they do the other things on the margins, but they do them in concert with each other. Not to pile on Lucy's former colleague at Succession, Will Tracy's show, The Regime, but just as a reaching into my increasingly limited mind archive of television shows.
My little shoebox of references.
It's just my cache clears after 8 days. Do you know what I mean? I'm like the security footage at a 7-Eleven.
Born baby every Monday.
No, when the cops are like, "Do you have footage of that?" And they're like, "Nope, we just tape over the same stuff."
Oh yeah, that's my favorite. Yeah.
So the thing about the regime is, even if I found it like sharp or the performance is clever or the satire, you know, like hitting the bullseye, I don't really want to hang out in this unnamed Central European country week to week. It's not that great for me. And one of the reasons why I really liked this episode of Shogun, we don't need to jump straight to it yet, was because it took time to be like, look where you fucking are. Think about it.
Yeah.
Sit with it for a second.
Yes.
And I appreciated that, considering there were also going to be cannon firings later in the episode. So that's my read on it. What would a perfect 2024, you know, let's push it forward, 2025 bathwater show be in this economy?
Well, okay, so I don't think I did a really good job of explaining myself.
No, Van said that, but I thought you were good.
My point really about the keeping 70 characters straight is that, for as much as I'm sure from the perspective of somebody making television, they're like, I put all this work into something and someone's right. folding laundry while they're watching it. That doesn't seem like a good trade-off. For me, I'm like, I was just saying that for, I think a lot of TV watchers, if they're doing more than one show at once, have a lot to keep track of,
right.
you know, and it's just as much work to watch television in some ways when you boil it down as it is to like make television for
right.
us to watch. I know that that's not true, but let's just pretend it is. And then so my point largely was like, I think that we are kind of operating at the limits of what the human mind can kind of comprehend when it comes to like, hey, 70 characters
yeah.
and all these different plot lines, and also maybe having a slight awareness that you're being artificially manipulated to extend to 10 hours or extend to 2 seasons or extend to whatever it is, it winds up becoming a little bit of a challenge. And sometimes having a show that you know you're just going to like walk in and out of, which is actually how my formative years were spent watching
sure.
television, because I didn't have a DVR, because there were commercials, because you know, sometimes I got home at 8:35 instead of 8:28. So I missed the first 5 minutes of a show. Like that relationship to television felt somehow more natural.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, 2 points that I want to respond to in what you're saying. One is, I think that the conversation, I don't want to put words into Sam's mouth, and everyone who creates things has their own perspective on it. But to me, like, a creator can only control so much, and they can control what makes them feel good and comfortable about the work they put into the world. And like, so from my perspective and my vantage point, not making Oppenheimer, for example, like Christopher Nolan's process is to micromanage every second of a movie and every frame and everything that you're going to hear. And he obsesses over it, and he wants it to be presented in the perfect, in the optimal
yeah.
way, in 70mm, IMAX, all these things. That's beautiful that he does that. That's wonderful that he does that. He is also someone who understands that people, sometimes like your humble narrator, will watch these beautiful movies on the back of a Delta airplane seat. It doesn't mean he shouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
But you cannot control how things are received ever, whether you're like worried about how your political messaging is going over, or, you know, when you're posing for photos with Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow, for example, or, you know, how much you frame fucked something until it just looked absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
You can't control it. Doesn't mean you shouldn't put in the effort. The second point, though, is I wondered if you think that that the sort of intellectual effort of holding all of this stuff at any given time, does that change when something is well and truly binged? Meaning, is that an argument for watching 10 hours of a Netflix show in 24 hours? Because then you are just immersed in a world in the way you would be in a movie. Because my understanding of like Fremen culture is diminishing by the second.
Oh,
now that
yeah.
we're 2 weeks away from Dune Part 2. But what I mean is, if you're trying to manage multiple characters in a complicated, smart story over 10 weeks versus over one weekend, does that
change
your
relationship? I think the three-body problem is going to be a very interesting answer to this question, because it's not... I think it's quite good. I really like what I've seen so far. Like, really like it. But...
You just broke your own embargo.
No, the embargo's been lifted,
no,
so I could
the
go...
CR embargo. The CRGO.
But... there's a lot of physics in it, and yeah. it's really dense, and it's going to be like hard for people to just be like breezing through it. I think. I mean, you maybe it's been created to do that, and I'm missing the point. But I'm watching it piecemeal, and it's a homework assignment. It's like you definitely have to like keep your mind wrapped around multiple timelines and like really heady ideas. In my experience, the bit stuff that gets really binged is something like One Day on Netflix, you know, which is like,
it's very good,
which is it is quite good. It is quite sad. And it is 14 episodes, about a half an hour or so each.
Right.
And they takes place over, it's like one day a year in the course of this relationship between these two people who meet in college.
Is that the full title? Is it the way, remember the Fiona Apple album? It's like When the Pawn, but really it was really long. So One Day is just what we call the show. That's actually
year. And honestly, it actually is a pretty good partner conversation topic.
I liked it too.
I knew it.
Did you finish it?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, did you cry?
Yes, I did cry. Not as much as during Normie Peeps, but...
Yeah. Some tears in the Ryan household. Not on my part.
Real G's ever.
At the end there.
It's a real tearjerker. So anyway, my point was like, that seems to be the kind of like thing that gets binged where it's like, this will give me a desired emotional response rather than I need to think about the origins of the universe. I could be wrong. The Lucy Prebble comment about Get Back, I thought was interesting because while it's like, yeah, you know, like you could just kind of like interact with these characters that you see on screen, but like in a passive way, it's like, well, they're also the Beatles. So I think if it was just like four dipshits from Dayton, Ohio, like playing in their garage, we probably wouldn't have the engagement numbers.
Is there 100 hours of Guided by Voices making Propeller in 1992? Is that what you were just...
Would you watch it?
Yes. I have a lot of laundry. So, yeah, I would. That sounds actually amazing. I also do want to say that when you read this profile before I did, and then you texted me, you were like, here's some interesting...
Here's the interesting section, yeah. Do you have some other takeaways?
Well, no, it's just that when you texted me and you said, did you see what she said about Get Back? And how, like, and I saw that you were like, you know, laundry folding conversation. And my brain said that you were talking about Get Out. Mm. And you were like, why aren't more TV shows like the Jordan Peele film Get Out that you could just chill out about and fold
laundry
to?
And why didn't movie theaters allow us to fold our laundry while watching Get Out? Yeah.
BYOL. Yeah, I do that.
Did you watch Get Back?
Yes, but in a very Lucy Prebble way.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you if I watched all of it. I watched some of it sometimes. It's a very good profile. It made me very interested in her plays. It also blew my mind because watch fave Ed Solomon shows up, the writer of Bill and Ted's and also of Full Circle, the show that we love with Soderbergh last year. They're married. They have a new baby, and they met over Twitter and then Zoom during lockdown. I'm like, what? Wow,
really?
Real? You didn't read that part?
I didn't see the Twitter and Zoom part. Maybe I was treating this article as laundry TV.
But your home is immaculate. Your East Side home. I mean, your beach pied-à-terre is TBD. But that he'd written something in 2021 about like being mistaken for the Boston Strangler or some funny thing from his past.
Yes.
And she had retweeted it and he was like DM'd and then they were chatting and then they were Zooming during pandemic. And then when they went to New York to film Succession season 3, he went over to where she was staying and they almost got busted by the quarantine police.
Really?
And now they got a baby.
That's a beautiful story.
And his first wife was John Cleese's daughter. He's fascinating too.
Huh.
You know what, Chris? We cover television, but you know what's really wild?
We're mapping the human heart.
Reality.
Yeah.
I was blown away by that.
Do you have anything else to say about this? I think it's an interesting ongoing conversation. Here's one thing that is more interesting to me, is that the shows and the showrunners don't get to decide how people watch these things. And
right. This is the thing.
That's kind of... In my case, I'm probably reacting to feeling like I have a little bit like of a volume issue in terms of how much stuff I'm watching. In other people's cases, it might be, you know what? I think I know what's going to happen in this scene, so I'm going to go get some peanut butter. And I think that there's a lot of different reasons why people watch things in a lot of different ways. And to your point about Oppenheimer, it's like, yes, there is a optimal viewing experience for that film. Is there also a legitimate viewing experience for it if you're watching it on your laptop in bed or watching it on your phone or watching it on the back of somebody's head in an airplane? Yes.
I mean, I would say I'm patient zero for that, or exhibit A, because I saw Oppenheimer with you and Sean.
Yes.
On IMAX.
Yes.
And I was blown away by the experience. And I also, as I said on this podcast, felt things from a Nolan movie that I hadn't before. Like I did feel legitimately like I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've loved some of them and I've been mid on some of them. And I've generally been like, my thing that I don't love about his movies is that they are so deeply unemotional. I don't understand a way in. watching that movie in the way he intended, I was like, oh, his emotion is expressed through sound design.
Yeah.
You know, like that is actually what he is passionate about, and you can feel that in the movie. And that is a very different experience than people who watch it streaming on Peacock. You know, and anecdotally, people who I know who have done it that way, if they like Nolan, they like it. And if they've not liked Nolan, they feel the same way about this as all the other ones. To the other point, I want to zag on one thing.
Okay.
Which is, when I say we, I don't mean us in this.
You mean the royal we.
Well, royal is a controversial term these days.
That's true.
This is blowing up. We got to bring Kaya back in on this. It is a, I'm going to zag on the idea that like we as podcasters, we make hay from talking about modes of distribution and how we watch things and where things go. But I do think it has absolutely bedeviled the industry that the supposedly creative community, and it's not just writers, but even development executives and people on that side of the ball, have to spend so much of their waking hours thinking about how things are going to be received, which pipe it's going to be fed into. Mm-hmm. That, for many years, that was not part of it. That decision, that conversation was in the head of the creator being like, is this a book or is this a movie or is this a TV show?
Yeah.
And then there were three pneumatic tubes like in Hudsucker Proxy, and then you just went about your day. The idea that people are spending so much of their waking hours being like, you know, I think I imagine this as a binge on a streaming service, but one that appeals to this demographic. So to sell it to them, we have to tailor it this way. And then we have to remember that if we're doing it that way, we have to do the episodes in this manner. Or even Lucy Prebble idly musing about, you know, maybe people want this because of how I'm watching people receive my content. It's just getting very muddy. I just feel like maybe all this will shake out in a few years and it'll be clearer what's a TV show, how TV shows are watched, and then we can move on from there. But I do think that there's an argument to be made that some of the, not hesitation in the work, but some of the, honestly, some of the confusion in things that we've been covering over the last few years is directly connected to people spending so much time thinking about the shape of it as opposed to what they're putting inside of that shape.
Yeah, I would argue that probably, if I had to say, I would say folks should worry about making the best possible television show they can, telling the most interesting story they can, because a lot of what Lucy Prebble is talking about is just watching YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that too. Like sometimes I will put on the 4K video of a guy making breakfast in an Australian campsite with just his dog. And it's pretty awesome.
Who's holding the camera?
No, he just sets it up on tripods.
Oh, I thought the dog was holding the camera. Okay.
That would be...
I was much more interested in that. I do think
that you'd be like, I don't think this guy deserves an Oscar either.
Oh, like the dog from Anatomy of a Fall? That dog deserves an Oscar. Who are you referring to?
I think I was just referring back to your anti-Scorsese takes from Monday's pod.
I think the voting history of the Academy is on my side. I think that, you know?
It's a great place to be on the side of the Academy.
I don't argue with the will of the voters. Okay?
Should we get into Shogun?
I think we should. And I also just want to say, good job by you, because I think that the conversation that was sparked by this New Yorker profile is relevant to the two shows we're talking about today.
Sure.
Because I think both have done a very good job navigating
these
tripwires and such.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid. Featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB mintmobile.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
So let's talk about the fourth episode of Shogun, Eightfold Fence. The Eightfold Fence is the name of the episode, and it was written by our old Grantland colleague, Emily Yoshida. So shout out to Emily.
That was exciting to see. I'm really happy for her.
She's also hosting the official Shogun podcast, which you can listen to, and she worked deeply on this show, I believe, as a staff writer, correct? And so Emily wrote this fourth episode, which is a more contemplative episode, I think, given after like the sort of momentum of the first three. This was a necessary kind of like, let's sit, let's talk about earthquakes.
Let's sit and look at the rain.
What did you think?
I thought that this was a beautiful episode that was also, to your point just then, very well placed. I keep coming back to what a fan I am of the construction of the show as we've seen so far.
And the construction of the season.
Yes. Like,
and I haven't watched ahead. So for all I know, I don't know how this is going to unfold, but like, to me, the lineup card has been set exactly right.
This is it's almost as if Shane Steichen is calling the plays. Do you know what I mean? In terms of just knowing when to mix it up, like you come out throwing and then maybe a run surprise you. I think that that's remarkable because, you know, both from talking to people in the industry, from my own experience being in writers' rooms, I've found that one of the hardest things to keep your mind on, or that for showrunners to keep their mind on, is that overall macro conversation of the pace. Like, you spend so much time crafting each tree that you're not always thinking about how the forest is going to hang together. So three wildly paced, riotously exciting episodes where so many things are crashing into each other, literally and otherwise, let's be in a place for a second. And let's think about the place that we are in. And not only in the more traditional, or at least not traditional in a necessarily in a good way, but a more outmoded type of storytelling where it's about stranger in a strange land and look how strange this land is. It is that it is presented as this is beguiling and it's beautiful. And sometimes you sit and look at the rain. And I thought that all that was so great. And I made me appreciate the kind of action flex at the end of the episode even more. Because again, this show knows what it is. And you can feel very comfortable relaxing into it.
Well, I also thought that the overall theme of the episode seemed to be individuals trying to define themselves outside of various systems of control. Like, whether that's being a soldier, whether that's being what country you're from, being Japanese, being British, whether that's being a pilot or a military tactician, whether that's being a Catholic translator or a daughter of some. You know, we haven't really gotten Mariko's story yet, but like, we are starting to get flashes of it. And I think it's obviously going to have a substantial impact on the whole arc of the show. I also thought this was a really awesome episode of supporting characters becoming main characters in some ways. Like, even Fuji felt so fleshed out by the end of this episode. So I really thought that this was like a necessary gear shift to give us like a lot of nuance, and also like, frankly, do the thing that TV does really, really well, which is time spent equaling depth of feeling and time spent equaling depth of relationship. Because when you get to the end of the episode, and there's some ambiguity about like what happens towards the end, I'm talking pre-canon, but when we get to the end of the episode and there's this moment of sexual intimacy for John, like, I think there was some confusion a little bit online. And I don't know officially like who he slept with.
You don't know.
Well, do you know? You think it was a courtesan?
Well, I was confused, which is intentional. And then I did a little cursory Googling, and the consensus seems to be that it was Mariko.
That's what I thought. I thought you thought it was like a courtesan. Like, I thought you thought she was telling the truth when she came outside the next day and was like, "We got you a girl. Hope you liked it."
I think that was me falling for it and watching the episode after dinner.
Okay.
No laundry. But I just got to be honest with you. I made a lovely dinner. Maybe made me a little sleepy.
Okay, so that's what I thought too. I thought it was Mariko, but for a variety of reasons.
By the way, I love this game of chicken we're playing where it's like,
who's going to be wrong? who's gonna have their name on being wrong about this?
It's not just that. It's that if there's one thing our friends at FX have made it clear to us is that they are listening and available for just spot checking stuff. But neither of us were like, hey, gang.
I think that it's played for,
yeah,
for there being some mystery to it. That being said, if it is Mariko, it is the consummation of like basically 60 minutes of these two people becoming, if not falling in love, like growing very close over the course of the episode.
Well, hot tubs do that.
Yeah. And earthquakes, baby earthquakes.
Baby earthquakes.
You want to comment a little bit about seismology in...
It's not that. The one thing that makes me laugh, and it does, there's no other way to tell the story, is just that Mariko and John Blackthorne are the most proficient Portuguese speakers in the history of the world. They would speak on such an elevated level of Portuguese discourse that Cristiano Ronaldo would be like, huh? Do you understand? Their education in this language, which again, no disrespect to our millions of fans in Brazil, is not traditionally one of the great like five world powers that every student learns.
But at the time, they were
language.
Running shit though.
They crushed this language to the degree where Blackthorne is just like, what does he mean? The things that he says when he thinks no one can understand him, except I guess Mariko and the audience.
Yeah.
When he's like, how do you say fuckery in Portuguese?
Oh, so do you always think, is he only speaking Portuguese?
No, my assumption
is, he's cursing people out, he's doing it in English.
But then Mariko does a little smirk, and is it because Portuguese curse words, you know, being a romance language, there's a lot of overlap? Or she knows this dude at this point. My favorite scene was when they're outside, and there's a little temblor, as they say, and he's like, my God, what the devil is this? The earth moving beneath my feet. What is this place, the Japans? And she's like, ah, you don't know this thing. This is, and then in beautiful, mellifluous Portuguese.
I'm on the edge of my seat wanting you to just do Cosmo Jarvis the rest of this episode.
She's like,
Saquon Barkley, all Eagles.
Howie Roseman never overpays for running back. In this market, I suppose with the cap going up, it's possible. I don't like it, but it's possible. Ugh. But she's like, in perfect Portuguese, she's like, that's an earthquake. And he's like, earthquake, you say? Well, I suppose my Portuguese master never used that term with me. But it makes sense. The earth, it quakes. We all... All right. You get what I'm saying? Maybe what we're seeing is that he is saying, you're sweating.
I just love this so... This is honestly my favorite fucking thing you've ever done.
I think that we are seeing that John Blackthorne is actually a language prodigy. Because in the span of that scene, he is undone by the tectonic plate movement, learns a new word in a language that isn't his own, and then
throw some scenarios at you? Like, what about John Blackthorne walks into a contemporary CVS?
Right.
Is the Afrin behind the plastic shielding?
Where the devil's the toothpaste?
What buccaneers have come through and taken all the Afrin?
I see, makes sense. Spike of crime. Post-coronavirus. Security guards. Where are their swords? Their weapons. Oh, encourage not to confront. Well, makes sense, I suppose. Tacticians. Everyone. Is that a pharmacy? But
God damn it. It's so cool to just be able to have it on demand like this.
By God, the Easter can.
Fuck. Greenwald, you are the best, man. Don't let anybody ever tell you anything otherwise.
Are we stepping down for a while? Just to like towel off? This is a new vibe in here. I like it.
Fuck. Okay. So that's the Blackthorne and Mariko thing. I also really, obviously, yeah. I made a joke about it in the opening of the pod, but I really enjoy it when guys eat stuff that they're not used to eating and are like, and they have to.
You want it again. You want it. Can't overdo it. But bit like cheese.
Have you had natto?
Had natto.
And what's
so natto is
what's the green
it's like green overly fermented soybeans, and they ferment to the point that they get kind of sticky and like pull apart
and ripe.
Overripe. It's ripe. It is a fermented product, so it is like cheese, which is not something that was eaten in Japan certainly in the 17th century. Sure. It's an acquired taste. It's not even so much the taste as it's a texture thing.
Yeah.
But I thought that was cool that was a beautifully observed moment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't overly indicated, which I thought was good as well. Like the sort of the taming of this Western barbarian is being done like in relatively subtle degrees. And I liked that they weren't explaining, well, this is, here's what we do with the soybeans. He was like, I would also imagine that our guy has eaten much worse.
Absolutely. Do you know what must have been happening on the black ship while he or like on his
ship?
On
yes.
his ship,
they hadn't at the beginning. They had no food.
They had no
right?
food. They had no water. Yeah, so. he was taking sand measurements and just being like,
I think he's doing well now. Again, as someone who is recently, even just on a casual
do you think
level,
that captain is bummed out that he put a bullet in his own head right before they got to Japan.
You got to see the journey through. I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I guess the counter argument would be maybe he's the one who gets boiled alive.
Yeah, then you're like, I really would have preferred to take a...
I had a moment.
Yeah, exactly.
As someone, again, who is sort of in a casual house hunt of his own, how did you feel about Black T's just kind of like, he kind of negs his
I think
house.
That there is a housing abundance in these towns that I want to get to the bottom of, you know?
Right, where they're like, find him. No, I disagree. I feel like there's a lot going on behind the scenes where they're like, get him a house.
No, because
I
when
think they kick someone
Ishido's
out.
Men show up when that guy shows up, Jozen, and it's like,
yes,
yo, like, houses for all these guys. I'm just like, we're yimbying out here. You know, like, there's just so much inventory that visiting soldiers get their own quarters.
I assume that for every visiting soldier, someone is put out on their ass.
Oh.
Like, I think that there's a hierarchy here of like who gets to have a house.
Yeah.
And who's in charge of. I don't think anyone is.
So you're just like, if you're like a fisherman or something and Yabushige is like, we got some.
None of this belongs to you.
Yeah. They're like out. Yeah.
It is a collective property ownership, you know?
Okay. Anyway, yes, it would be great if somebody was just like, here are your quarters now. And it was just like right on Manhattan Beach. That would be sick.
Yeah, and they're like, and also here's your servants and your consort.
I think my wife might not love the consort part.
Well, there are aspects of it that she would like. And maybe in the Blackthorn model where he is not taking advantage of all the pillowing.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that she might enjoy. For example, we learned in this episode that the consort can't go to bed until the host goes
yes.
to bed. You are on record that sometimes late night SVU puts CR to ZZZ town.
Yes.
So in this scenario, Fuji-sama would stay awake with Phoebe and watch
SVU.
SVU.
Yeah, and chat. Yeah.
And just chat because, look, we love, she's a chatter.
Yeah.
Like she would like a late night talk.
I'm sure. There's a lot to be explored there. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of political and militaristic
yes.
maneuvering that goes on. So I thought that the opening scene where Tornaga is basically doing a Nick Saban speech as this crowd just goes absolutely wild for him.
Hiroyuki Sanada is so good.
Yeah, and
in this scene.
And the fan up and down. Yeah. Like he has, I know that he's talked about like how he was so hands-on with like when the script would come through. And then when they were on set, Sanada apparently would go around like adjusting the posture
yeah.
of different actors and stuff like that. And you can tell he's holding himself to that same standard because like, it's just like, it's very iconic. It's really quite a performance so far.
And you understand why they built the show around him. Why they filmed that one day just to keep him and the property alive.
Yeah. But it's funny. When he leaves, I was like, fuck man, that's my guy right there. Like, I want to spend more time with him. And I'm sure we will. But like, he is the battery of the show, kind of.
I also related to his social strategy because there was a whole period of years in New York where I would be like, let's go to this place. And everyone would land and we'd have a similar like warm welcome. And then you'd be like, cool, how long are we staying? And I'd already be in a taxi.
Yes.
Leaving.
Yeah. The Greenwald goodbye.
he bounced.
But you know, this is to my point about people discovering their own identity and choosing their own paths and stuff like that. Like I think that for Omi, for Torunaga's son, to some extent for Yabushige, like they're trying to decide like who am I loyal to? What are my duties as a son? What are my responsibilities to my own manhood? You know?
But let in the light of the conversation you were having before about keeping track of a lot of characters, this is a show that is primarily in a language we don't speak. And is not just introducing a ton of world and a lot of historical context and culture, but also many characters in different geographic locations.
Yeah.
And yet it is so artful in it that like Yabushige is already one of my favorite characters on television, full stop. That Omi, within this episode, makes a very, very strong and clear impression. That's really
when he smiles when the when Torunaga's son is going off and he's just like, I got him.
That's really hard to do. But it's not just that he's doing the got him, it's that they laid the track so that when they're having their little sake time before, you're like, I see the machinations here.
Yes.
Now, is that because we've been watching a lot of shows about tortured family dynamics and power machinations recently?
Sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But Shogun doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it's playing off of that in the same way that you said at the beginning that, like, oh, there's some Game of Thrones energy to the credits. Like, I just feel like the show is operating on a very elite level where it is training us in certain ways to expect things or to put our minds in a certain place so that we are receptive to all the shit they're throwing at us.
And the kind of brash youth rebelling against the staid maturity of their elders is on display in the final scene, which is so gory and so thrilling and so breathtaking.
Kendall Roy, Ian.
I guess we've just moved on from protecting horses, you know?
do you feel like the California legislature weakened the post-Luck?
I understand that this is entirely CGI,
As someone who watched real horses go down watching Luck, I could tell that this was different.
Yeah.
My only thing was, at the end of this episode, this is the one time that I was a little, not out of it, but like, when did they move the cannons to hit them?
I think earlier in the morning when they didn't, I don't know when Torunaga's son and Omi have their pregame drink.
Right.
Maybe that's the night before.
It's the night before.
So then maybe he goes out and he's just like, let's reverse everything here.
I'm fine with it, clearly, but also for dramatic purposes, of course. I think I have two different strains of thought that are colliding. One is it's very clear that when you're at the top of the power structure, you can have anything done at any time for anyone, and people are willing to do it. But I did feel like how many cannons did they have? And they did not strike me as the most mobile.
But they're actually, I think they are a little bit smaller, but your point is taken but the whole point is this pinpoint accuracy, I guess.
And do you think Blackstone was just Blackthorn? See, you did it. I'm thinking about you. Do you think Blackthorn was just just still kind of feeling?
You're going to give me one last dash of it?
Now I'm feeling pressure. This must be how you feel every day you walk into the Rewatchables taping.
Maybe I should just stop doing impressions, you know?
Oh, how dare you? How dare you? But I just mean, I feel like Blackthorn must be a little bit in his still feeling post-coital good energies.
And he's also who did I sleep with?
But he didn't notice.
What's with the question marks over this?
But he didn't show up being like, had five cannons, count three. What happened to the other?
But
running
he does do this. Is no one going to stop him again?
That is his main thing.
Yeah. Great episode. Really enjoyed it. So let's move on. I wanted to touch on the gentleman.
Do you think that when you're living on the West Side, you will just sit on your deck and watch the rain? Did you have any desire to have that kind of nature kinship that he seems to have?
Yeah, but if I did do that, I wouldn't want to do it in California.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You'd want to do it on Arrakis? What do you mean? Where are you going?
I don't know, Maine or whatever. My back to the land movement is going to be outside of the greater Los Angeles area.
Could someone?
I'm not going to do it in the valley.
We are not on the Torunaga level of influence on our troops.
Uh-huh.
But if someone could take the shot of John Blackthorne sitting, looking out over his garden in the rain and Photoshop an iPhone into his hand where he's watching Andrew Huberman reels.
Uh-huh.
While the rain is falling. So he's watching that instead. No, I think we'd all know that it was you. That's your ideal
setup. It's a
very
specific request, but I'm sure it'll be fulfilled very quickly.
12 years deep, everything we do is specific. That's how we make great art.
Dude, I fucking love the gentleman. You know, and I say that with I know how many episodes this is. The first episode is 67 minutes.
It's long.
It's a long one. It's based on the 2019 Guy Ritchie movie with Matthew McConaughey and Charlie Hunnam and Michelle Dockery and Hugh Grant in an outstanding Hugh Grant turn. Did you see the movie?
So I want to ask you about this. So I have not seen the movie. I'm a relative newcomer to the Guy Ritchie expanded universe.
Oh, okay.
And I'd like to know, did I need to watch the movie?
No, you did not.
It's not a one-to-one, or is it just
at least
the same
so far
vibe?
I have not detected a real I think that the premise of the illegal weed industry in England is largely the baseline of the film.
I was not shocked that there is a weed industry in the UK.
So this iteration of the story, it stars Theo James and Kaya Scodelario, who people may remember from Skins, mm-hmm. UK, and has been around for a minute, but she's fantastic in this. So the basic premise is as follows. The show is about this guy named Edward, who is a UN soldier when we first meet him. He's actually the second son of the Horniman family, an aristocratic British family who have owned a sprawling estate for hundreds of years and gotten up to some shady business over that period of time. The father dies, and it's all supposed to go to coked up twat Freddy.
Mm-hmm.
I say that pretty much quoting, but it instead goes to Eddie. There's also a daughter named Chuckles, who is told in the will that she is to sail around the world and marry a man.
Well, she gets a boat as long as she sails around the world within 6 months.
And marries
she
a man.
She gets an
allowance.
Allowance of £1,000 a week until she marries a man.
Yes. Eddie also inherits Jeff, a muscle-bound groundsman, and a business relationship with Susie Glass, as played by Kaya Scodelario.
But Jeff is played by Vinnie Jones, so I bet he has no secrets or physical prowess.
Exactly. Who is running a weed business underneath the grounds of the estate. Mm-hmm. Throw in a Scouse cocaine cartel, a scammer named Sticky Pete, and a mysterious rich American named Johnston with a T, played by Giancarlo Esposito, who has a wine drinking process that I really want to ask Andy about.
Yeah.
And you've got a rogues gallery. The show looks great. I think it has just enough Richie-isms in terms of the filmmaking to keep you on your toes and keep you engaged. There's just like a zest and a panache to the dialogue that I loved in the movie and I love in the show. It is like just an absolute romp, honestly. Like it's violent, it's profane, it's well done. I love the pitch that everyone in the show is singing from. I fucking love the guy playing Freddy. I think he's on Lovesick.
He's amazing. Daniel Ings.
He is cooking. He is blackthorning out.
England just has just such a deep bench of these guys.
You like this, though.
I really like this. And I really, really liked it because, again, like in the light of this conversation we're having, like if you want to make a gourmet cheeseburger or a gourmet pub grub, whatever the UK equivalent would be, hire people who know what they're doing and know how to have fun. This is so light on its feet and so grabby and so confident that like it makes it look kind of easy. And this is not trying to be a prestige Sunday night show. This is exactly what it purports to be. Like this is
it's honestly, it reminds me of The Boys.
Yes.
Totally.
Sure. Yeah. And that it is profane and violent, but it's, and like The Boys, it's very well cast and it's very clever. And I got to give a shout out to the former Mr. Madonna here, because all I could think of while watching the pilot, he directed the first two, I believe, is the what do you call it? When Steve Coogan is playing Alan Partridge and his face is floating and he just says, liquid football. Because everything is just so beautifully designed and the camera moves so perfectly and every thought is considered. And there's just these little touches of wonderful detail, like when Susie Glass, who's the Kaya Scodelario part, she walks into the fish market to confront the crime boss, who also is chopping
Peter Serafinowicz, yeah.
He's chopping up hake and mackerel, et cetera. And it's Peter Serafinowicz. So that's you're already positioning from a position of strength. She's walking in her high heels in a fish market, and there's just a moment where she comes up against a guy who's just mopping.
Uh-huh.
And they sort of have a moment of collision, and then he pulls the mop away. It's the tiniest moment, but in less expert hands, you cut that for, you know, and it tells the larger story.
And then there's like a delightful scene after that where it's like her and Peter Serafinowicz's character are negotiating Freddy's debt to this Scouse cocaine mob. And it's got like illustrations on screen and translations for slang. And it's like, basically, like just so indulgent and so fun and so so interesting to watch, honestly.
It's okay to have people who look good and are good at doing stuff. Like that is genre entertainment at its finest.
Yeah, how about Theo James, man?
So let's talk about Theo James, who I do have a thought, and we can maybe punt this forward to the third season of White Lotus conversation we'll inevitably be having next year. Because I do feel like one of Mike White's secret talents is he just might be a true core talent vampire, in that when he casts you in White Lotus, be careful, because I feel like he reaches into your soul and exposes your best I'm not saying these are who these people really are, but they're like essential on-camera selves, to the point where they're almost like withered husks when they go back into the world, because no one is ever going to capture them at their best again?
Okay, so go ahead.
So I sometimes wonder that. That said, D.O. James is very handsome, very debonair, with a kind of a quiet menace, and he's very charismatic. And he's the perfect, it's not that he's a cipher, this, he's a real character, he's going to be moving through this world, but like, he is also, he's almost like an action figure being moved through this crazy funhouse carnival ride.
Yeah.
And I think he's perfectly cast. It's not asking too much, and it's asking just enough.
Yeah, he's really good at walking into a room and going, what the fuck?
Yes.
Or going into a room, and if somebody is like, how is everything going? He's like, poorly.
Yes. You know?
But he has, like, he's a guy who's, like, done a lot of, like, he was always, like, the other hot guy in a YA movie for a while.
Right.
And then I think was like maybe going to be this romantic lead for a while, but like there's only so many romantic leads left out there.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to have aged right into his like platonic ideal age, like mid 30s or whatever he's at right now.
He's pushing 40, but yes.
And just having a little bit of weather underneath of his eyes and a little bit of like seasoning to his game has like changed it. And he's a believable, like, aristocratic stud, but he's also like, I bet this guy can fight. You know, like
his costumes are just, I would watch.
He's just wearing barber jackets. He's balling out of his barbers.
He looks great. But let's also talk about the movie to TV thing. Because one of the things that's great about this, I think, is that he is playing a more traditional movie part in the sense that I don't really care about his backstory. We're introduced to him as he's a UN peacekeeper who gets along with everybody.
Yeah.
Fucking great.
Who everybody seems to like grudgingly respect upon. Yeah.
And that get done with that so fast, and that just sets the tone for
who
he is.
James Bond. It's like when James Bond walks into a fucking room and it's like, you know how to play every card game, you have an opinion on every wine, you have like, it's like he is just a Wikipedia of being a cool guy.
But that's a movie character generally.
Yeah.
And one of the best archetypes of movie character, and that like, I just trust someone who is competent and can move through a world that I know nothing about, like, done. Great. And I love that. And I love the confidence with which they're just basically setting up a movie story. The only thing that I kind of, my only pause in this, because I loved this. I had a great time watching it. I am going to watch the rest of this season, was it is quite long.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a moment, like, there's so many highs and so many, like, and it's moving.
There's like four episodes in the first
episode. Exactly. And then when we get to the chicken dance stuff at the end, and it goes on for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And the outcome is quite clear relatively early in that runtime. That was the first time when I started to be like, oh, is this going to run into a kind of pacing problem that movie people run into when they're like, that'd be mad as a TV show, wouldn't it? Like that, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, a TV show, you say?
Never heard of it.
Now you're being bashful. Now
I'm shy. I was thinking about it. I was thinking about how they make a lot of the television sets in the Japans, but I'm not going to do it.
Your point is well taken. I do think that also there is a yes and quality to the storytelling where it's like you get to the end of like, it seems like Edward has like fixed the problem. And then at the very last moment, the problem gets undone again and he has a whole new set of problems. I think that will probably continue to scale out. You know, like
That's the show.
Yeah. It's whether or not you enjoy the vibe. To me, I really enjoyed
it. I love the vibe. I thought it was it's just an elegantly put together show. Like, even just that the confidence of the opening, like, this is who this guy is, and let's go.
Yeah.
And then when he pulls up to the estate, and the title card is just transposed beautiful font, yellow lettering over this wild-ass manor.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's nice to be...
So Richie has been with us since we were in college, really. Started with, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. Yep. And I think that you could take a whole swath of the movies he's done, which he has like a couple of different, strangely, careers within his career. Like
he sure
has
does.
His own material that he has sort of generated that is largely about the London underworld crime world.
Mm-hmm.
Then he also has Studio Hired Hand, where he's done, you know, Sherlock Holmes movies and, you know,
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Yeah. He did the Aladdin movie.
And then in recent years, he has been incredibly prolific in this almost like Robert Aldrich, like old school genre, workman-like, prolific genre director.
Mm-hmm.
So he has pumped out, like, The Covenant and Wrath of Man and, like, Operation Fortune, which is this kind of Daffy, Jason Statham, Bond style caper. So, but like he's incredibly prolific. He's got The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen coming soon, and then also is already like making another Gyllenhaal movie, I think.
Well, he also has made, he made an action movie with John Krasinski and Natalie Portman, like Fountain of Youth.
Oh yeah, right. That's what he's moved on to, yeah.
He's very busy.
Yes. So, and in the meantime, it was funny. What was I? Oh, I was just watching, like, you know, he has like the aesthetic of Ed, of Edward, is Richie. Like with this refined aggression, this likes the fights, but also loves a hound, you know, hounds chasing some foxes.
Well, and an 82 Bordeaux.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I like to go out and watch underground boxing, but also drink incredibly fine wine. I would be remiss if I did not ask you about this one scene. So Giancarlo Esposito.
Before you, just last Guy Ritchie thing, we also were talking about him the other week because he's announced as the director of the Donovans, the...
Oh, yeah.
IP-related
Ray
Donovan
that's right.
companion series. That's going to be the London version of Fixers. And that just made me triply psyched now. Because I've not, as I've said many times, like I think I saw Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I don't know if I've seen anything
You've
else
seen
Guy
Snatch.
Ritchie's made. No.
You've never seen Snatch?
No.
You should.
I guess I should.
I actually really like Rock and Rolla, too.
I never saw any of these movies.
And I like Wrath of Man a lot,
too. I was doing adult travel baseball that time with the fellas. You and the rest of the nerds were in the cinema.
Okay. Anyway, my whole point
Oh, you
was,
want to ask about the scene?
Well, before we get to that, my whole point of going through his career was just to say that in many ways, he has been telling a variation on the same story for most of his career anyway about the London underworld. So I think that have like a 10-hour, you know, very long kind of runway here for that, it kind of makes sense. Whether or not it's going to get repetitive or feel a little bit stale by the end, I don't know. But like, I'm very excited to check it out. There is a scene in the first episode.
Yes.
Giancarlo Esposito shows up. He's this mysterious guy named Stanley Johnston. He's incredibly wealthy, incredibly refined. Clearly has a lot of admiration for British upper class, I guess.
Yeah.
Seemingly.
He also has a helicopter.
And a very particular way of drinking wine that I wanted to ask you about before we went, which involves him essentially... decanting it through a paper filter to clean the liquid,
yeah.
Then cleaning the bottle of all sediment, then replacing the wine back in its original housing to be enjoyed.
Right.
Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard of this, yes. I'm going to be honest with our listeners. I don't generally drink 40-year-old red wines, so this has never been particularly relevant to me.
Okay.
In my
you
life,
do this with like a 17 shard.
Yeah. No, like a California Roussanne from like 2002,
yeah,
and break out the Mr. Coffee filters. Everyone, this is going to take a few minutes. No, I mean, I think that there's, because people have seen decanting before, and there's the idea that it's to let some aerate
oxygen,
the wine a little bit. And wine, there's sediment in wine the older it gets. And I think there's a spirited debate about whether the sediment is essential to the character of the wine. Like if you're drinking an older wine.
Yeah, should you be drinking
that is part
that
of it.
Peat.
So what are you taking out when you filter things out? And also, are you affecting the flavor profile by putting it through paper? You know, like all these different things that some people care about more than others. So I think, based on my deep knowledge of Guy Ritchie personally and professionally, as well as on screen, that he is telling us something about Stanley Johnston in this scene.
Okay. That he's precise.
Well, that he's precise, but also he doesn't like things to be messy. He likes to control situations. And that he might not, in fact, have the ability to walk the walk of, what is it, refined aggression?
Refined aggression.
That maybe he's more refined than
aggression.
Do you think
Giancarlo Esposito is like, I really like to play a fucking slob?
I wonder this. Thank you for asking this, because you mentioned The Boys.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, I imagine that the history of Hollywood is just marked with examples that I have no access to now because, again, cleared my cache, but that of characters who are like, I found my lane, I'm just going to play it for the rest of my
career. Yes, it's called character actors, yeah.
Well, but like not just character actors, but like what's his name from, like Sidney Greenstreet.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, you're going to, I almost did it. I'm not going to do it. But he's, you know, that he plays the same part basically in Maltese Falcon and... Casablanca, more or less, because that's what he was brought in to do. So I feel like it's very well-paying for Giancarlo Esposito to be a very precise man in a suit with menace. But this at least had a little more pep in its step. I think him on The Boys, I'm like, you're just wearing Gus.
There's
rings.
Also a feeling of that where it's like they shot for 3 days of him like standing in Vought Industries, where it's like with this, I think hopefully there will be a little bit more juice. It also seems like an incredibly fun thing to make because you're just playing billiards in like a $10,000 suit.
I am so here for just the lifestyle porn of all this, and the frippery and the suits and the billiard. Like, yeah, let's go.
Money well spent, Bella Bajaria. That's all I got to say.
I agree. This is a good show. Do this, TV.
That's what I thought.
You were worried, though.
I wasn't worried. I actually, the second it started, I was like, Greenwald's going to like this.
Because in the opening moments, he's keeping the peace as opposed to like murdering someone. So you knew that I wouldn't.
No, as soon as Freddie starts talking during the will reading, I was like, Andy is going to really enjoy this.
Oh, it's so good, that scene. Also, I will say, speaking of Freddie, do you know our guy Freddie Fox shows up this season?
Edward Fox?
Edward Fox, Freddie Fox's father, plays...
Yes.
The dying patriarch.
So, yeah. Does Freddie Fox show up in the...
Freddie Fox is on the Wikipedia as a cast member of the show.
Yeah, which we haven't seen yet.
So, I don't know when or for how long, but the fact that our guy, young Bumpy Knuckles from the Slow Horses universe, is on the show makes me really excited.
Thanks to Kaya for her real estate insight and mm-hmm. also her production know-how. Mm-hmm. And thanks to our listeners. We recorded this on a Tuesday. It'll be going up. I mean, we could put it up a little bit earlier if you wanted to, but this will be our second episode of the week. So if we missed anything in between Tuesday and Thursday, culturally speaking.
Or like breaking news.
Yeah,
or...
but like what constitutes breaking news in our world, you know?
Here's the only thing I'm worried about, what we just laid down to tape, is that I did make like a sort of flippant reference to the missing princess. And then like, what if the truth comes out by Thursday?
Yeah,
Kaya, do you think that's possible? Do you think we'll know? Will our listeners know more on Thursday than we know now?
If anything develops in the next, like, I don't know, 24-ish hours, I will record a solo addendum.
That's awesome.
Can we just, we give you full producerial permission to just drop in.
Let me tell you something. She has it anyway.
I know. But I wanted an audio record.
I wouldn't know how to stop her.
I consent, is what I'm saying. I consent.
Okay, sounds good.
Keep us up to date.
Okay.
It's funny that you think mm-hmm. that this international mm. conspiracy is... hinges on whether or not you make fun of it on a podcast.
It's going to be wrapped up?
Yeah.
No. I'm okay. You just are misunderstanding where my values are. Like, I will go on this mic and be like, wow, I can't believe Blackthorne slept with Torinaga.
Yeah.
Like, that was wild. Like, I don't care about getting that wrong. But I am...
But Kate Middleton.
I never want... Well, she's Kate to us still.
Yeah.
From the New York days. I never want to get a single detail wrong about her. Because those late night pierogies
at
Veselka...
Also, libel laws in England are different.
Yes.
So think about that.
Yes, and you and I might be there at some point soon, and then I don't want to get nabbed at the airport.
That's right.
Right?
I don't want
that. Right? Have a great weekend, everybody.
Border control, you say?
Certainly not here for me.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.